Stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. Stand up for truth.
I truly believe that thoughts are the greatest vehicle to change.
We do not care whether the cat is black or white, as long as it can catch mice.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be.
To those waiting with bated breath for that favorite media catchphrase, the U-turn, I have only one thing to say. U-turn if you want to. The ladies, not for turning.
If I have seen further than others, it is by standing upon the shoulders of giants, is a quote from Sir Isaac Newton, the English mathematician, physicist, astronomer, theologian, and author who is widely recognized as one of the most influential scientists of all time. I thought the quote and who it is from was apt for our guest today, who believes that mathematicians can do anything, yet ironically missed out in the younger years to study maths, but as chairman has had the opportunity to work with and oversee the giants in corporate Australia. Today's podcast is a rare opportunity for those wanting to know how one of the most experienced business leaders thinks and operates. This is insight from a person who started out as an article clerk for a prestigious law firm, built a formidable reputation in mergers and acquisitions, became partner by 29, later chairman, and has touched or influenced almost every sector in the Australian economy. Our guest today is Kevin McCann, AO, who during his illustrious career has challenged the establishment, has championed new thinking in the boardroom, has broken down the Directors Club, and in so doing had the privilege of being chairman of Macquarie Group and Bank, Origin Energy, Healthscope, Citadel Group, ING Management, the Sydney Harbour Federation Trust, and was a director of BlueScope Steel. Today he's chairman of Telix Pharmaceuticals Limited and China Matters, a director of Evans Dixon Limited, and a trustee of the Sydney Opera House Trust. He was made an officer of the Order of Australia for services to business, corporate governance, and as an advocate for gender equity. Hello and welcome to another episode of No Limitations, a show where we speak to elite world-class performing men and women and unlock the secrets and influences that have shaped their destinies and that you could apply to your own life. I'm your host, Greg Robinson, Managing Partner of Blenheim Partners Executive Search and Board Advisory Firm. In this episode, Kevin shares with us what a chairman looks for in a CEO and what is leadership. What are the machinations in the boardroom and what's changed? We also examine the tough questions surrounding Australia's global competitiveness and cover tax reform, red tape, the environment and policy, the learnings from the Hayne Royal Commission, immigration, innovation and creativity, as well as the role of business in society and actually what is diversity. So sit back and enjoy this open and very wide-ranging conversation. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Greg.
Kevin, can you talk us through this illustrious career you've had?
Well, I'll start at the beginning.
Okay.
I grew up in Perth. My family came to Sydney when I was 10. I was educated at Sydney University, tertiary education, did a couple of years of postgrad in Harvard. I trained in arts law and did a postgraduate law degree and worked at a firm called Allen Allen and Hemsley and came back after I'd finished my postgrad work and was there for about 40 years.
And what was the fascination with law? Was that from mum and dad, friends, family, or?
Well, it was sort of forced on me. I didn't do STEM subjects, so that wiped out medicine, it wiped out being an engineer. And so having a liberal arts background, law was the obvious career.
And in those days, Kevin, was there an area of specialization for you?
Not really, no. We, in those days, apart from criminal law and divorce, an Allen's partner did everything from wills, family law to corporate transactions.
And you were made partner at a fairly young age, if I remember rightly?
Yes, when I was 29.
So what do you think made you stand out from the rest?
Well, I was had reasonably good academic grades. The thing about the partnership in those days was that most people had honours degrees. Very few of them had done postgraduate work. But I came back with reasonable academic background. I was hardworking, ambitious, and curious.
And with that, Kevin, how long did you stay in law for?
Well, I retired as a lawyer in 2004,
mm-hmm.
but the firm in those days was very generous. They let their partners take boards. Okay. So that when I finally quit in 2004, I walked in to I had a very large number of boards, Macquarie, Origin.
So what was the genesis of that, Kevin? What made you want to go from being a practicing lawyer to building this career in the boardroom and also a very successful career in the boardroom?
Oh, well, look, there's nothing planned about it. I did a lot of work for Pioneer Concrete. The founder of that company and executive chairman was Sir Tristan Antico.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I collaborated on some very big transactions for Pioneer. Right. Out of the blue, when I was 36, he said, would you come and join the Pioneer board? And that absolutely shocked my senior partner, who said he's made a terrible mistake and rushed down Macquarie Street to suggest some other partner get appointed. But Tris was the sort of person who backed individuals and liked youth. And I fitted the bill.
What were the challenges that Pioneer were facing in those days?
They didn't have a lot of challenges in those days. They were on a very rapid acquisition phase. It was one of the few international companies. And so we had good footprints in Hong Kong, United Kingdom, and Europe, but we went into the United States, and we went through ASEAN countries as well. So it was a case of a rapid expansion in the core business.
Kevin, in building your board portfolio, what are you looking for? What are the key characteristics that are going to make you join that board?
Oh, look, in the early days, it was people offered me opportunities, and a person who was very generous to me was Nick Greiner when he was Premier. HCF was an organisation controlled by government that was in trouble.
Right.
And so he asked me to go onto that board. I didn't know a lot about health, but I rapidly discovered that was an area of importance and interest. He also asked me to go on the rail board, and I didn't know much about trains, but that was fascinating. So because I was curious and I enjoyed doing research, I found that I could move from sector to sector, and after a while, people told me, for instance, in health, that it would take me 5 years to understand it. I found I got on top of it reasonably quickly by doing adequate research. In later years, of course, I became a lot more careful about opportunities I took or was offered, and yeah. spent time on due diligence to satisfy myself that I had the qualifications needed, or I was interested in the sector, and that I felt the people I was associating with were people I wanted to be engaged in business with.
You've also worked on some, well, I guess throughout your career, you've been on international boards. Comes to mind, obviously, Origin Energy, Macquarie Group, and chair in both. What's the dedication required from a chair in such organisations?
Oh, Greg, the role of the chair is completely different from the role of a non-executive director.
Okay.
He or she is the link between the board and the chief executive. He or she has to set the agenda for board meetings. He or she has to pass on tough messages from the board to the chief executive. As Don Argus said, you have to be friendly but not friends.
Yeah.
So it's got to be a professional relationship, and you also have to spend a lot of time communicating not only with your chief executive but also getting to know the senior leadership group and understanding their strengths and weaknesses.
And in your experience, Kevin, what's changed over the last 10, 15 years of the requirements to be on the board and also to engage effectively in the boardroom?
Yeah, look, in the early days, it was a part-time activity. Boards were populated by people who had retired, inverted commas,
mm-hmm.
were generally elderly males. It's completely changed. The role of a director is now a professional role, and you have really a case of continuing learning. You've got to understand the sector. You're working in. You've got to understand the regulatory framework. You have to be across economic trends. You really, really, really need to know the strengths and weaknesses of your business. And where the opportunities from growth lie. So being a professional director is full time, and being a chairman, there's a limit on how many roles you can take and fulfill the task properly.
Do you have a thoughts on that, and how many roles one can take? Do you think there's a view out there that some directors are on too many boards?
I think there's some notable examples. I would have thought two major boards would be an absolute stretch. In the UK, it is usual for the chair to be expected to put in the FTSE 100, three or four days a week into the company, and you would only take one major board.
What sort of time would you put into both Origin and Macquarie when you were chair?
It actually varies because if you've got business as usual, which you never do, you've got the half year and the full year, which are always a busy time. If there's major transactions, it can be 7 days a week. So in the case of Origin, when there were takeover bids, in the case when we had our relationship with ConocoPhillips, that involved a great deal of time and travel to the United States to undertake the transaction that was being proposed by them. So if you've got major litigation or reputational issues, you've got to be basically available when required.
You mentioned the word regulation a bit earlier, Kevin. Has that changed somewhat in the last 5 years?
Oh, the last 5 years. Well, I was going to go back to when I started corporate law, and the corporations law was a very slim volume. Now you cannot get a printed copy that's up to date because of the number of amendments that are being made. So the corporations law is complex. The laws around your industry are complex, where it's environmental, things like the Modern Slavery Act, things like the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which is now being quite rigorously enforced. More and more, you've got the ASX rules, which are much more extensive. So it's completely changed. You've now got if we look at the lessons of the Royal Commission, I think one of the things that happened is that we had profound changes to financial advice, the future of financial advice, and we also had the consumer protection laws on responsible lending.
Yes.
And I think the industry failed to realise the cultural change that was required in the way they did their business.
Okay.
And the leaders, as leaders, we failed to take our workforce along with us, so that while people will grumble about the Modern Slavery Act, that is a very profound piece of legislation that requires leadership to explain to people why that was brought in and why we have to take it seriously.
How do you test for it, Kevin, along the journey? As you say, social norms and social expectations have certainly changed. And as you said, maybe the leadership might have missed that. But how do you keep up to speed with that litmus test?
Well, look, you can look backwards and look forwards. Mm-hmm. Looking backwards, you look at customer complaints, you look at compliance breaches, you look at breaches of control rules. So that's all looking back. But I've concluded, Greg, that looking forward, it's up to the leaders to actually think about what the legislation is going to do to their particular industry, and then not outsource it. There's a great habit of going to one of the big four accounting firms and asking for a manual, and handing the manual to the workforce. You've actually got to personally go and explain the policy behind the legislation and what we have to do to comply with it.
And with that, Kevin, and the pace of change, is the level between the execs and the directors getting a little bit muddled?
I think there's a huge blurring of responsibility. And Greg, if you're in the highly regulated industry like the finance sector, there is a danger that that the regulators and legislation is requiring directors to get involved in management.
Too much so?
I think we're getting very close to that situation, yes.
So very, very important, and I guess looking at your career there, you've got good chief execs and leadership teams underneath you, but you've had some very, very good chief execs in you.
Look, I think that's ultimately the key to business success. It's the quality of leadership, and it's the culture of the organisation. And Macquarie is an example of that. They appoint from inside. So I've worked with really the three people who have led Macquarie. They all had long periods with the company, and they absolutely believed the Macquarie culture, and it was a very simple set of guidelines, which is opportunity, accountability, and integrity. And it was a bottom-up culture, not a top-down strategy.
Okay.
A lot of people struggled with that who were on our board. They were used to the top-down where the CEO would say, we're going to South America. Nicholas Moore or Shamara or Alan Moss would never say, go to South America. It was a decision by the individual groups as to whether they saw opportunities there.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, right. Yeah. How did the board guide through that, Kevin?
Oh, it was very challenging because Macquarie had at one stage about 8 groups and a whole lot of subgroups, and they were highly specialised. So for a non-executive director, particularly people who didn't come from the finance sector, it was very challenging. And given that the company now has got a large principal book where their own capital's going into transactions, you had to understand renewables, you had to understand the difference between wind and solar. You had to understand the subsidies that supported those kinds of transactions, which of course made it a really fascinating organization to be involved with.
You're also across international markets, and with both, you know, energy trading and the banking environment.
Yep.
You're exposed to politics, you're exposed to some key decisions which you've got no influence over.
Hmm.
How turbulent and how difficult and how big were some of those calls you got involved in?
Well, first of all, you had to understand the environment you're working in. Mm. And America, I think it was Oscar Wilde who said that two countries divided by a common language. And we make the mistake of thinking because we speak English, the environment is the same. The American environment is different from the English environment. Each country is different, and also Canada. So we really needed to understand we're in a different environment, and we'd have to tease out some of the puzzles. Why is it America, which has terrible infrastructure, awful airports, problems with bridges, problems with water and sewerage? Well, because it's a federation, and you've got states, and states still have a lot of authority, and despite being the land of the free, Americans like public ownership.
Yeah, right.
So that was a puzzle to us, and there was no culture of privatization that we had in Australia and to a large extent in the United Kingdom. So we had to get our heads around that if we were going to succeed in that environment.
What about the likes of the global financial crisis?
Well, we had a situation where Nicholas came in 2009. My chairman, David Clark, became very ill, and I was an acting chair. So he had an acting chair and a brand new CEO. And September 2009 and March 2010 were really, really challenging times. And
how tough was it, Kevin?
Really tough, really tough. We had, you might recall, Greg, that the government banned shorting of stocks, and they provided support to companies for borrowings, and they gave the Reserve Bank also provided support as well. But despite that, the shorts were very clever. They discovered credit default swaps, and they started to short those, so that we were being shorted in a very opaque and unregulated market.
All right.
And so from September, when Lehman collapsed, to 2010, mm-hmm. were probably our toughest moments. But my board was, as acting chairman, were absolutely united. There was no panic. And Nicholas Moore, I've always described as a man for all seasons. We knew he could make lots of money in the bad times, but Nicholas turned out to be an outstanding leader in the really tough times.
And what were the lessons you learned from the board and under pressure?
Boards are interesting. Some people head for the hills when the going gets tough.
Yeah.
If you've got a strong board, we work together. Obviously, you have the chair and the CEO and probably one or two other directors and some key executives form an ad hoc subcommittee to work through the issues. and then you keep your colleagues involved as the transactions or issues get resolved or arise. And I found that was a good way to deal with a crisis.
You also faced other crises in sense of oil price and the whole battle in energy. Where do you see energy policy in Australia, Kevin? You've been chairman of Origin Energy Group. What is happening and what are we supposed to be hoping for?
Well, I think there's a couple of things to say before I answer that question. One is that we have got into this situation through very poor policy.
Yeah.
With hindsight, we probably should have had a reservation policy, which was the one which America had. America didn't allow exports of oil or gas till they were absolutely certain they had a huge surplus. But our resources up in Queensland would not have been developed without export contracts. So we had that issue. But having said that, we also had a renewables policy, which was not well thought out. And so we got a situation where renewables started to put the aging kit plant of coal-fired power stations out of business.
Yeah.
Now, having said all that, Greg, we're in a mess, and how do you dig yourself out?
Well, because no one's giving us an answer, Kevin.
Well, answer number one is Victoria and New South Wales should stop their moratorium on the exploitation of coal seam gas. The Pilliga scrub has got the resources to fix a lot of the East Coast issues. The second,
so that's fracking.
Yep. And
so there's a couple of outspoken people against that, as you know.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. But the truth of the matter is that the science is in favour of fracking if it's done responsibly. So you can't have a fracking without impairing the water table or polluting the artesian basin. So that's one thing you can do in the very 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 short term. I agree with the sentiment that we do not want a complete flight of our manufacturing. And so we're going to have to find some way to subsidise the manufacturers while we get through this 2 to 3 year period.
So in your experience then, the level of engagement between business and governments, mm-hmm. where do you see us compared to other parts of the world? Are we so far not joined from the hip? Obviously we're still battling around this whole policy on energy and it's been going backwards and forwards for a long, long period of time.
Well, it's complicated by the federal system. When Anna Bligh was Premier of Queensland, you couldn't have had someone more supportive.
All right.
And as a result of her support to the industry, we got the three plants at Gladstone.
Yep.
But then the federal government got involved because it decided that the states on an individual basis weren't capable of fixing the supply problem. But unfortunately, we've had chops and changes in the policy, and breaking up vertically integrated companies is not the answer, and to have price controls is certainly not the answer. We're going back to the solutions of the early 1950s. But where you've got a market that's not working, you do need to provide intervention that's sensible. And as I said, I think if we got the supply flowing in from Victoria and from New South Wales, we could fix it in a 2 to 3 year time frame. But in the interim, we're going to need a solution to provide so that we don't have more and more manufacturing activities leaving our country.
What about the price of carbon, Kevin?
We were at Origin always in favour of carbon trading. The John Howard initiative in 2007, a cap and trade, we thought was a very good system. And in New Zealand, where we had a business, the Clark government brought in a cap and trade system that worked very well, fairly low price, but signalled that carbon wasn't free. And if you had carbon emissions, you needed to take action to abate it.
Where do you see us, Kevin? I guess why we're talking about this now on a broader scale, Australia's role and Australia's future growth potentials in the sense of our exports and our relationships in this ongoing trade war discussion we hear and read daily.
Look, Greg, we've done very well in commodities, and I don't subscribe to the view that it was all good luck. The people who developed the iron ore and the coal did a very fine job.
Yeah.
The LNG people have done a good job, and dare I say it, Australian universities who have $35 billion of exports done a good job too. But as Governor Lowe said, we can't rest on our laurels, and so we've got to get ourselves into a country where we're fit for the 21st century. And I'm really optimistic about our technology and some of our pharma startups. And we have some really good companies who have got global platforms. And that is the key to it. These companies have got a solution to a particular matter that the world wants a solution for. And they have global platforms as opposed to simply being domestic companies. And that, I think, is a really good place to be.
Are they getting the capital support, Kevin?
Well, we don't have the pools of capital that you've got in the United States.
Yep.
And the pension funds and the industry funds won't support that generally. So it's going to require private capital.
Yep.
And that is at a very, very infant stage.
Yep.
But I'm involved with a pharma company, and there is money in Australia for these kind of companies, which are high risk, but will have the opportunity for really providing great solutions for treatment of people with cancer, and having a global platform in cancer treatment. China, most Chinese people reporting to hospital are in stage four, which means they are not going to survive.
Right.
So if we can have programs where we can offer them the ability to be diagnosed at an early stage,
yeah,
we're going to save a lot of Chinese lives. And I think President Xi Jinping is very supportive of those initiatives.
So where do you see our relationships with China?
Well, it's a big challenge. The challenge for Australia is how do we continue with our policy of the alliance with the United States? So there are people saying that we can't have the balancing act any longer, but I think the wise heads in Canberra believe that we've got to work on that and be agile enough to manage both relationships.
You mentioned the play of private investment. There's comments coming out of the US that you and I discussed earlier in regards to large corporations potentially going more private. Do you see that happening in Australia?
Oh, it is. I mean, private equity is extremely well funded and is certainly got the capital to take companies private. And there's quite a number of companies really that, if they can access that capital, are better placed because the capital is more patient, whereas the market is not particularly patient. And we are expected, and to have a setback in a market the market punishes you very, very severely, as you've seen in the reporting system, Greg, people dropping 20, 30, 40%.
Kevin, what do you think of that? Capital was lost overnight. Confidence is suddenly down overnight based on analysts making an interpretation, or maybe you're a chief exec or a chair, as we discussed, so you're maybe not prepared to give guidance in uncertain waters. Are we actually measuring success properly?
Well, I think responsibility is on both sides. And having reflected on this, I think that if you've got a share price that's at some extraordinary multiple against EBITDA, I'm beginning to wonder if we shouldn't express some caution, but of course, no one wants to do that. They think that's wonderful. People enjoy the fact their share price is flourishing.
Yes.
But the consequences of disappointing are so profound that it would be better to have a steady increase in a share price rather than spectacular increases. And with small caps, the retail people can get to, what is it, Kane said, animal spirits, and the price gets bid up.
Where do you see the whole discussion regards bonus and REM? You've got proxies, you know, going to slap people over the wrist. Strike one, strike two.
We spend an awful lot of time in Australia on remuneration. And we are having to rethink the standard model. I think that in the finance sector, we now retain a lot of the earnings, a significant proportion of the earnings. But of course, the model there is different: low base, very high bonus. Whereas in the case of conventional companies, the base is very high, and the LTI and the STI is the add-on.
Mm.
But I think retention of some of that is going to be needed in order to ensure that where there is unsatisfactory performance or errors, that there's a sanction after the event. Because at the moment, you'll find that people get paid out LTI awards, and then 2 years later, you discovered something's happened in the company that really was negligence or worse.
So you're supportive of clawbacks?
Yeah.
Mm. Wow.
Yep.
Anything that's we've done that enough in this country?
My experience of clawbacks is the lawyers get hold of them and tell you you can't claw back. And so what we're realizing now that if you're going to have a clawback, it's got to be in the absolute discretion of the board. Now you might think that's an alarming prospect, but the fact is boards act responsibly. We're not going to turn off our management without really good cause. So we're not going to be irresponsible. We're not going to be capricious. Otherwise, we're going to lose our management. So I think that's the only way we can make clawbacks or malus clauses work. But we haven't got there yet.
No, but there's been a number of discussions around it, and some good arguments for some reasonable cases. Kevin, the board's got one big role: the hire and fire of the CEO. How do you judge a CEO? What are the characteristics you look for? Because you've had a couple of very, very strong CEOs.
Well, you've got to have CEOs, Greg, who are macro and micro. They can see the big picture for their company, but they've got to be across the detail. You cannot be a big picture person and neglect the detail. And so the people that I've worked with who have been outstanding have been able to grasp that. Leaders also have to be constantly before their workforce. So the town hall meetings are very powerful and not to be perfunctory. They've got to be genuine and they've got to be authentic. They're people who have to be adaptive, because given we've now got a community that is very judgmental of corporations, we've had this debate over who are the true stakeholders.
Yes.
Well, a conventional legal position can accommodate a large number of stakeholders have to be taken account of. So we've also got to use the Hayne question, not can we, but should we, and that requires judgment. And so you've got to have people who I'd call holistic. You also have to be smart, and smart people can hire other smart people without feeling threatened. If you've got mediocre leadership, you generally have mediocre senior executives. Outstanding leaders are not threatened. When I was a lawyer, I always loved having people smarter than me because it made life easier.
Very common sense, isn't it? What about the appointment of directors? Is there enough due diligence done?
That is a really that's a challenging issue. You do DD and you talk to referees, and in most cases they're invariably very supportive. I've had a couple of cases where I've rung a referee and said, "Whatever you do, don't hire X or point X." But I think I think more DD needs to be done, where you go in depth talking to people who have worked with the individual when they were in a professional or working career, just to understand their characteristics, personalities. But I found that when you do a thorough DD, you get what you are expecting. And so you have to be up for the fact that if someone is a director who's the loyal opposition, they will be a robust challenger. You'll find other people who are very detailed, and you can accommodate both of those. You need a detailed person for some roles. You need the robust challenger who can do it in a collegiate way for boards, and then you'll find out who are the strong people in a crisis. How did X company Y or Z had a crisis? How did X perform? And did they head for the hills, or were they really there to assist the chair and the CEO? So I think that's my learning. We have to do better on DD.
You mentioned a couple of things, which was the role of the professional NED, as opposed to when you first started out, people were retiring. That was the next career. A recent guest of ours suggested that the success of a business, 30% of it is impacted by the composition of the board. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, look, I think, frankly, it's the CEO and his or her leadership team that create the success of companies. I've been on some successful company boards, but we had an oversight role. we were there when there was the good times and the bad times.
Yes.
But you'd have to give the laurels and the credits and the triumphal march to the CEO and their team.
But in the composition of a board, Kevin, I guess what I was wondering was, as you said, you're sector agnostic.
Mm.
With, I guess, greater scrutiny of boards now, are you feeling more pressure to have people with stronger or closer industry pedigrees to boards? How do you come about this, you know, the build of your board?
Well, I'll give you an example. My strengths now are governance and stock exchange experience and capital markets. And so in both the boards I'm on now, they're highly technical. So we've in the case of pharmaceuticals, we've got biochemists on the board.
Right. Okay,
and these people talk the talk and they know the chemicals that we are dealing with. So there's no question, Greg, that you need industry experts and people who can tell you where the industry is headed. And even inside a pharmaceutical industry, radiopharmaceuticals is a specialist sector of its own. So the gifted amateur has a limited role today. You're going to need people who could chair your audit committee who have been auditors or CFOs. You can't have someone. When I was on Pioneer, I got eventually appointed as chair of the audit committee.
Right. Okay.
you couldn't do that today.
Fair enough. Are you finding that again with the extra amount of scrutiny on boards and names and back pages of papers, etc., there's still a willingness that I'm going to move into the boardroom, or a number of people saying, "Look, I've done it. That's enough. I don't want to be a part of that circuit anymore."
Look, there's some very good people who have worked overseas for majors who have come back to Australia. And have said, no, we're not going to take public company boards. We'll go and work for private equity.
Yeah,
we will become investors and assist management, but we don't want the regulatory burden or the scrutiny or the fact that we're subject to all sorts of factors like short-termism. So I wouldn't say it's become an avalanche, but some really good people won't take boards.
And Kevin, are we spending enough time on business, or are we spending too much, as you said earlier, on the regulatory side?
Look, having left the financial services industry now, my worry is that they will become utilities, and that they will cease to be. They'll be highly regulated. I mean, a bank board now has lost the right, the autonomy to appoint directors and to set remuneration. That's going to be the subject of oversight.
Okay.
So I think that might chill innovation and creativity, and as a result, that will go to other places.
That's not good to hear, is it?
No, because the banking sector is really important, and it's absolutely fundamental for our society that we have an effective bank, not only for corporations but for individuals.
With the social licensing, we focus on social thinking. How do you check the company culture? Kevin, you're the chair. How do you actually litmus test and go past Mr. Moore? What do you do?
Oh, well, as I said earlier, Greg, we have the backward looking. We look at customer complaints. We look at staff satisfaction. We look at compliance breaches. We look at regulatory breaches. But going forward, what are we doing in terms of staff training? How many town halls did Nicholas Moore undertake when he was CEO? And he was impeccable. Every time he went on a visit, there was a staff town hall, which was very open, and he dealt with a whole range of questions. Have we got leaders who got the ability and are doing training of staff where there's major legislative changes? Have they explained to the staff the policy behind that and have not delegated to an accounting firm a manual and a box-ticking exercise, but people really understanding what the future of financial advice expects of people in that sector? And I think where the banks have realised they can't manage that, they've exited that particular business, and so you're seeing probably retail advice being subsumed by people going away from advisors and putting their money into industry funds.
Was the Hayne report a surprise to you, the outcomes?
Yes, it was. I was an insider and I didn't realise the extent of misconduct, fees for no service, being dead people being charged, yeah. People being sold insurance that at the time they purchased it could never claim on it. That shocked me, that surprised me because, and as I say, I was an insider and I thought we were on top of those issues.
So where does, I'm not necessarily looking for fault, but where does the culture come from? Is it the top, and was that the issue? Where was the lack of questioning, or we're not naming names, but what's your broader thinking?
Clearly, neither the boards nor the CEOs knew what was happening.
Yeah,
and my thesis, Greg, has been that we fail to understand the future of financial advice or the consumer protection provisions, and the consumer protections responsible lending were an absolutely seismic change because historically, if I lent you money to buy a house, I was interested to know that you could service the debt. But if you couldn't, I sold you up. The new law requires you to be able to say, Greg can service this loan without me having to exercise the mortgage. And that's a huge change in what is required in lending. And I don't think we got our heads around that. In the case of financial advice, the view was that you had to be in a position where you put your client's interests first. And we know that what was happening is advisors were actually pushing their own products and they were not thinking of their clients. And you'd think this is obvious. Why isn't this the case? Well, that's how the industry worked, but no one actually went down to the trading floor and said, these are the new rules. You've got to have written advice. You've got to be thinking of your clients. You can't be pushing your own products.
Without naming the name, Kevin, one particular company stands out, which has been unfortunately badly hurt by all this. Are they a classic organisation that would you suggest would better served by going private for a while?
My daughter actually works for them.
So. Oh, okay. Well, I'm trying to think.
The company you haven't named.
But very, very difficult when you're listed.
Oh, very. Yeah.
So is that a potential, is that a classic bit of way of thinking that would be prime for taking off the market, sorting out their issues, restructuring the business, then coming back to the market?
Gosh, I haven't thought of that. It's some of these companies are pretty big, aren't they?
Yeah, I don't know if it can be done or not, but it's.
I guess what's happened with the bank transactions is most of the companies have been most of their businesses have been sold to foreign organisations which are private. Yeah, I mean, sorry, they're public, but they're no longer in the public domain in Australia. So, yeah, that's probably the solution.
So, Kevin, taking that train of thought again in regards to a business which is in the public limelight. Is listed and has a lot of work to do, how are you going to make a bonus?
Well, that's the issue. The corporate governance groups say pay for performance. And when I've had this situation in a couple of companies I've been involved in, I pointed out, well, we can't promise you good results in the first 2 or 3 years, but we are going to turn this company around. And if we're going to keep good people, we're going to have to reward their efforts. And so we have to be more creative in the way we remunerate people of troubled companies. And the issues that arose were not of the companies making it. It wasn't as if the management was incompetent. It was the external circumstances which required a pivot. So therefore you had to recognize that. Now we got a strike and then we eventually persuaded them of the logic of what we were doing and there was a happy ending.
The role of proxies. Is it overstepped the mark?
Oh, look, there's been a lot of discussion. David Crawford and Lee Clifford were keen to have them regulated. ASIC has no appetite for that.
Okay.
But I do think they've now got a code of conduct, but certainly there's some basic housekeeping that needs to be done. So when they write a report, they should, I think, submit it to the company to see that factual errors are corrected because often the report is incorrect. And they have to issue a correction, sometimes they won't, and the company then is put to the task of undertaking the corrections.
And other regulators, Kevin, we mentioned it earlier, but have they been a little bit more aggressive than in the past?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, following Hayne, the head of enforcement at ASIC says we litigate and we don't negotiate. I think that's going to lead to a lot of congestion in the courts, and that's a very expensive way to deal with regulatory breaches. So I think the enforceable undertakings that the previous group at ASIC undertook were very helpful. As Nicholas Moore said at the Royal Commission, at Macquarie, we learned a lot from our correction of what had happened, and we came out better for it. Also, we remediated what needed to be remediated.
You've been through some ups and downs. Where do you see the plays in China versus US, Europe versus Brexit?
In terms of trade?
And in terms of confidence in business in Australia?
Oh, well, look at the environment's very, very challenging because there's so much noise. You've got a president in the United States who tweets policy, but he changes policy on a nightly basis. You've got Brexit and the EU, both the UK and Europe, EU, very distracted with the exit of the United Kingdom. And you've got in China, you've got a president who is changing the direction of that country so that state-owned enterprises are gaining more support from the centre, whereas previously there was a lot of support for the private sector. So these are challenging geopolitical times to navigate, and so you really have to be disciplined about what you think is noise and what is fact.
I know you're talking about the navigation, Kevin, but do you think there's enough positive discussion by our business leaders and our politicians about the opportunity that awaits us in Australia?
I think it's uneven. Actually, the person who I have a huge respect for is Dr. Lowe. He is very good at articulating the state of Australia and very clear as to what he thinks we should be doing. His view is we're okay, but if we want to be good, not necessarily great, yes, but if we want to make Australia good again, there's a number of steps we can take to engage in productivity reform. And also, he was quite clear on how we can improve wage growth and believe it or not, inflation. That's now a good thing after you and I have had years of being told it's a terrible thing.
That's right.
But he's very clear as to what needs to be done. And he's pointed out to the politicians that he doesn't need to tell them, just go and look at the 10 years of reports which haven't been acted on.
If you look at the last 10, 15 years of leadership that we've had in this country, political leadership, what advice would you give the current Prime Minister and his team in regards to opportunities and sense of reform? You know, there's arguments around we had opportunities in regards to tax reform. You mentioned the environment. What would you suggest?
Well, I'd suggest they go back and look at the Henry report on tax. That's a good starting point as to tax reform. There's discussion about indirect taxes and there's discussion about land tax. But the central thesis is why would you tax effort? So people who are energetic, working hard, why would you have one of the highest tax rates, individual tax rates in the world if you want to pursue innovation and creativity and for people to find Australia attractive to stay in?
What about company tax?
Oh, well, we're clearly uncompetitive. The great tax haven today, of course, is the United Kingdom. Was it 23% going down to 21? We're 30, so we're simply not competitive. And if you've got companies like our great companies like CSL or Cochlear and so on,
yep,
who've got global platforms, mm-hmm, if you're going to build your next plant, CSL's, I recently went and had a look at one of their plants in Switzerland.
Yeah.
Now, Switzerland is a tax haven, but on the other hand, under Australian tax law, if you're conducting a trading business, you are not taxed in Australia because you're in a tax haven. You pay the Swiss tax, and the Swiss tax is much more generous to companies like CSL than it is in Australia.
Can I ask you a broader question? There's some great Australian businesses that have gone offshore. Macquarie, you've been one.
Mm.
And others that we don't need to say the names, but we know of. And yet, I'm sure if we spoke to most chief execs and chair, and asked, was there ever a minister to help you in support of this great Australian company in building relationships and building opportunities? I got a bad feeling the answer is going to be never once saw them turn up. What are your thoughts on that? Because we do hear that the Americans make an effort. The Europeans are regularly known to roll out very senior and sometimes ministers of state. What are your thoughts?
Look, I think you make a good point. I think culturally we've not tended to depend upon ministerial or prime ministerial support. But as you point out, I think when the French were tendering for the submarines, it went to the president.
Yeah.
So I think that is a good point, that we could use the services of our prime minister appropriately where we have major transactions.
Kevin, your focus has changed now. You're not necessarily at the big end of the ASX. It's come down to the growing and developing organisation. Has that been deliberate, and why is it?
Well, the fact is the opportunities are at the smaller end of town, and I've really actually enjoyed it. You get very close to the executives. It's the regulations a lot less, which is extremely attractive.
Yeah.
And you also got a global footprint, so that to be successful in these companies, you're going to have a product or services which are sought around the world, not just servicing the Australian market. So in one of the companies, we had a very good business of undertaking activities in Australia, but we decided we wanted a global footprint, and for that we needed platforms which provided services or products on a global basis. And so it's extremely interesting at my final stage to be back on a global footprint again rather than in a purely domestic situation. Not to say I haven't enjoyed them, but these are new horizons, and I think that's our tech sector and our biopharma sector are very attractive places. There's some very good policies in place to promote them, and we've got the potential to be a 21st century sector. So that's the attraction to me.
And what about the red tape, Kevin? Is it not going to be prohibitive in that sense?
No, it's not. It's much less. Okay, we've got the Modern Slavery Act and the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, but they're manageable. So we can set our own remuneration. We don't have to decide who can join our board. We don't have to and we don't have individual responsibilities and reporting to a regulator. So it's much more attractive.
You've had a very busy business life and a man of influence. Where do you take the time to think?
Well, it's generally weekends, Greg, and you actually have to do a lot of reading, looking at, and there's a lot of material from a variety of sources, whether it's Harvard's Business School journals to The Economist, but also the management consulting firms put out some very thoughtful pieces, and I'm a serial attender of lectures and conferences where I've never come away without some insights that I hadn't thought about.
Kevin, it comes up every day. What is diversity for you?
We tend to think of it in gender diversity. And look, Australia's made great progress since 2008. We've done very well. So in the top 100, we've got 30% of women on boards. But as always with statistics, it hides the fact that there are only one woman on some boards, and in some boards still no women. But I think diversity goes beyond just gender. It's diversity of outlook, diversity of personalities. And the area that we haven't got to grips with yet is the fact that our society is extremely diverse. Yeah. What, 50% of our citizens have been born overseas or have been children of first generation Australians. And getting those people onto our boards, if they're appropriately qualified, is a challenge. And Greg, you at Blenheim have a big task here. You've got to start producing candidates from that sector. Now, I don't think it needs to be force fed. because these people are often very comfortable in the private sector, in family businesses, and they don't seek to go onto public boards. But I think, but certainly in the government sector, to the extent there are still boards and committees, that would be a very good start.
You make a really good point there, Kevin. The issue that I get is the pushback from chair and from boards. Not necessarily willing to accept that, i.e. Billy Bloggs or Mary hasn't had 10, 15 years on a board, or they haven't run a particular business across this sector. Gee whiz, we go to someone out of the government, you know, what are they really going to understand the pressures of a listed environment? That, when it comes to the crunch, Greg, really like the fact that they made your short list and then number five, but I don't think we're going to go with them. That's the challenge that we get back. And I like what you just said. Do you think there is a willingness to think like that? Because diversity does come up every day of the week, and it is normally around gender. But you might talk, as you say, look, someone who's been an outstanding chief exec from a private company, is entrepreneurial, et cetera, wanting to make the move into the board, and you know it could have an impact. A lot of the time, Kevin, we can't even get it up in the discussion.
Well, that's interesting, because I think that if you've got people on the board who know the governance, the ASX rules, not everyone in the board has to be an expert in every area. And, you know, what we want is a champion team, not a team of champions.
Yeah.
And so someone who's got skills in a particular area, let's say we're trying to market to China, and that person has relationships in China and maybe even family, that'd be a wonderful person to have. Now, usually they're not interested in going to public companies because they're doing very well outside. So I guess, Greg, your challenge is you've got to become more persuasive.
That's the challenge. You're 100% right, because I think we're missing out on so much opportunity. That's what keeps me awake at night, Kevin, is that you do your searches, you want to do the very best for your clientele, and you think, are they going to be open to that? Because there is some absolute outstanding talent, which may be not necessarily coming out on the CV, but we all know can bring a lot to the table. Which I guess went back to my first earlier point, was around boards thinking about, you know, the due diligence on the potential candidates who are going to join the board and the impact they're going to have. When you're making your appointments, are you hiring for the future, Kevin?
The answer is yes, we are. And again, you've made a very good point in that question. That is, Australia is going to get more diverse as a community, not less. And so people like us are probably going to be eventually a minority. And so, yes, you'd want people who can help us navigate into the new world.
Speaking of the new world, could we take it one step further? What is your thought and sense on the broader economy, where we hear about the debates on immigration? That's diversity. And that's also a big stimuli on the growth of the economy. But is it too much reliant on that as opposed to innovation?
I'm a reconstructed supporter of immigration. I think if you look at the this is not the only criteria. The 10 richest people in Australia, I think 8 of them are from first-generation immigrants.
Okay.
And these people came into Australia after the Second World War as refugees and have made incredible contribution to our country.
What would your advice now be, Kevin, to those contemplating commencing in a career as an NED?
Well, be curious. Make sure that you continue to expand your knowledge. Have an absolutely firm base of understanding what's required of a director, nothing like the AICD director's course, if I can put a plug for them.
Okay.
That's a very good start to a director's career. Get yourself a mentor if you can.
Have you had one during your life?
No, I had role models, actually. I listened to a lot of your podcasts and everyone else seemed to have a mentor, but I had role models.
Okay. And are you a mentor to anybody?
Yes. I mentor women directors who are board ready, and that's been extremely rewarding. And that's morphed into a number of women directors reaching out to me seeking advice.
Do they understand how the board, you know, the implications on a board these days?
Well, I think they do. Look, it's really often a matter of style. These people are very intelligent. They're extremely diligent in pursuing knowledge. I mean, a lot of people go to Silicon Valley and go to Israel to understand what's happening. So they're extremely good at doing that. It's a case of just understanding the intricacies of interpersonal relationships, because you're putting a whole lot of disparate personalities together in a board, and being influential in a board is really important. And if you want to become a chair eventually, having the characteristics that make a successful chair something that is acquired over time. So I think that it's very hard for economists to actually measure that. But mm-hmm. to me, immigrants have got the drive and energy, and it goes from the first to the second and the third generation. We've been so benefited by these people. I mean, some of them don't go necessarily into business, but go into academia or public service. But these people have made a great contribution.
Another question, Kevin. In the broader pursuit of growth for this nation, is there we look back many years ago and you had the Accord with Hawke and Keating, and there was a genuine feel that it was coming. I was only very young, but I remember looking at and watching it on TV, being inspired by the fact that there was discussions around from both sides of the fence. Is there enough of that?
I think we were very fortunate that period. You had Bob Hawke, who had a long history of trade union leadership, Bill Kelty, who I've been on a board with. He's a remarkable man.
Okay.
And although he's a trade unionist, but he's someone who wants to work with enterprises for mutual success.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, I don't think we have that situation because, of course, the union movement has the numbers of people in the union have declined significantly. Mm-hmm. So they tend to be centered in or located in areas of either government businesses or places like universities or teachers' federation, or industries like construction, which don't face foreign competition. So we're going to have to recreate a situation where we get collaboration, and that was the hallmark of the Accord, collaboration, which was remarkably successful. And then, of course, you had Hawke and Keating, who, in hindsight, were a remarkable duo.
There was also trust in business in those days.
Mm.
Where do you see it now?
Oh, well, if you look at the various groups that do analysis, it's pretty depressing. It's a difficult statistical issue because people have a distrust of banks, but when you poll them about their relationship with the banks, they're often very pleased. But
true, yes.
So you've got this dichotomy between what the community think about particular sectors and the individual's relationship. But industry's got a lot to answer for in terms of transparency. You've only got to look at food and the fact that we have been promoting products which are not healthy. We haven't empowered the consumer to look at the label and determine whether it's got sugar or other materials which they don't want to eat.
Yeah. As a chair, are you a coach? What is the role of a chair to the chief exec? Sorry.
Yeah. Well, look. That one tries to be, but sometimes there's some very self-actualized CEOs who are very bright, probably smarter than me, but I can navigate pitfalls because there's nothing like experience of what not to do and what to do than 30 or 40 years of sitting on boards.
If you roll it back 30, 40 years, and we roll it back when you're a young man, what advice would you give Mr. Kevin McCann those days?
I think I'd be more across STEM subjects. As a young boy, I got rather ill and had to go to the country to recover, and no one ever gave me any coaching to catch up where I missed out in maths and physics.
Is that right?
And languages, yeah. And as you know, maths is all about building blocks.
Yeah.
History didn't matter. If I hadn't studied France, I could always study Germany and do that question.
Yeah.
So in hindsight, that was a great pity. And if you look at some of the really outstanding leaders in the world, they've had very good mathematics basis. And I'm a great fan of mathematicians. They can do anything.
On that, Kevin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Good. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
You've been listening to No Limitations.